exploration of theirs.
Warning.
Get your official Adam Sank Show merchandise at adamsank.com. T-shirts, tank tops, mugs, masks, just about everything you can think of emblazoned with the Adam Sank Show logo. Go to adamsank.com to order your merch today. Thank you.
Warning. The program you're about to hear contains highly offensive and indecent material.
This is the Adam Sank Show.
If it's in my hand, I'm going to suck it.
Powered by DNR Studios. And now...
the one, the only, Adam Sank!
Bottom.
Bienvenidos al culo. That means welcome to the ass. We are coming at you live. If you're listening at 11 a.m. Eastern on Saturday, March 6th, 2021 at dnrstudios.com, the only place to hear this podcast live and throughout the week that it first airs. Don't forget to download the brand new DNR Studios app. It is the easiest and best way to listen to all of the LGBTQ podcasts provided by DNR Studios. Leave us your ratings and reviews on iTunes or wherever else you listen to this bullshit. Email me at adam@adamsank.com. And if you're listening live, why don't you call in and talk to us? 804-825-5277. That's 804-TALK-ASS. You can call us anytime, even when we're not on the air, and leave us a filthy voicemail. We might just play it on the air. Like the Adam Sank Show Facebook page, download the comedy albums, get your official ass merch, t-shirts, tank tops, even a pet cock. I think that's part of a car. The link to all of that merch is adamsank.com. Our guest today is someone who is very important to me personally, because he actually played a small but significant role in my coming out story, and we'll be talking about that a little later. But it is the Obie Award winning playwright David Drake. His play "The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me," which went off Broadway in 1992, really defined an era, the era of ACT UP. Of the devastation of AIDS, and yet the energy and the hopefulness of the activism around AIDS and dispelling homophobia and the creativity that came out of that time. His one man play, "The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me," really typified all of that, and it was a sensation. So I'm thrilled that we'll be talking to him a little later in the hour. But first, it is time to introduce my co-host, the Prince of Pigs. Today, he is wearing I almost want to show the Instagram viewers. He's wearing a tracksuit, some sort of camouflage tracksuit. Oh, look at that big booty. Welcome, Ryan Frostig, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello.
Ryan, tell us about this outfit.
So I basically only wear sweatpants these days, and
because... Is that because you're fat?
I'm fat, I'm a housewife, I'm a mother of a puppy, and all I want to be in is sweatpants, so this is where we're at.
There you go. Well, I think it's adorable.
Thank you.
And also with us, as always, is the queen of fuckery, Ms. Bercy, JB.
Hello.
Ms. Bercy, if you're nasty.
Oh, I am. Yes, I am.
JB, I feel that you're a little bit, something's on your mind today. You're a little quiet for I'm talking about before we went on the air.
Oh, no, it's just me hating where I live. Usual crap. There's no train service for the whole month.
JB lives in Far Rockaway.
Yeah, leaving Far Rockaway. So I have to wake up at like 7:30. Well, learn first. I woke up by 7, left my house by 7:30 just to get here at least 5 minutes before 10. Like, it's bullshit like
it's
that.
It's a lot.
Yeah. So it's just that sin knowing me plus on the way back. So it's more fuckery.
Well, we love you. We're happy you're here. Hopefully we'll be able to distract and entertain you with all of our nonsense today. And JB is moving at some point.
Yes.
It was supposed to happen already. So there is light at the end of the tunnel. Oh, someone's watching from Belgium, from Antwerp. Bonjour. Do they speak French in Antwerp? I don't know.
So.
Belgium's one of those countries where it's like it's a tiny country and they speak like three languages. It's muy confundido. Anyway, let's do
so
recommended.
What? I feel so ignorant. I barely speak English.
I just said something in Spanish, which is a language they don't speak in Belgium.
Well, there you go.
They do speak Romanish.
Oh.
Anyway, let's do recommended viewing. I'm going to start. I'm obsessed with Allen versus Pharaoh on HBO Max. It is a very one-sided yet compelling documentary about the accusations of child molestation that Mia Farrow and her daughter Dylan have made against Woody Allen and basically have been maintaining for 30 years now. It's just incredible. Yeah. I mean, it's almost entirely home movies that Mia Farrow made. She's in it. Many of her kids are in it. Her sisters, her friends. Again, it's very one-sided. And I have always had questions about whether or not Woody Allen actually molested this 5-year-old child. It always seems sort of implausible to me. But what the movie does is it makes a very convincing case that whether or not that even happened, he's incredibly creepy and inappropriate and always has been.
Yeah.
And has always been fixated on the idea of older men being with younger women, including underage women.
Yeah.
And they focus a lot on his art, you know, on the movie Manhattan, where the 42-year-old lead, played by him, has an affair with a 17-year-old high school student. And everyone in the movie acts like it's totally normal and fine. And his friends in the movie are like, oh, lucky you. And
right. No
one says, like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, that's not okay.
Yeah.
And the movie makes the case that, in effect, with this and so many of his other movies that deal with the same thing, that he was, in effect, grooming us. He was grooming the audience to accept this as a normal, healthy thing for a teenage girl and a grown-ass man to be together, when in fact it is not.
When did that movie come out, Manhattan?
I think 79.
79? And when did Jerry Seinfeld have that relationship?
Very good question. So this was – someone just wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about that. That was in the late 80s.
Mm.
And again, there was a lot of, you know, sort of head shaking about that. But ultimately, the two of them were on the cover of People magazine together. And everyone said, isn't it great that this 19-year-old woman and this 39-year-old man are making it work and they're so in love? And like – again, like a really gross abuse of power, especially when you're rich and famous and you're doing it.
Right.
You know, so we've come a long way since then. But the 70s was a particularly heinous time. I mean, you had people defending Roman Polanski for having sex with a 13-year-old girl.
Yeah.
Whether or not he raped her in terms of the traditional sense of rape.
Mm-hmm.
He raped her.
Yeah.
Like statutorily. And there's never – there's no situation in which it's okay for an adult to have sex with a 13-year-old. But in the 70s, there was just this abdication of parental guidance, as well as sort of like anything goes. Like let's get rid of all confines, and if it feels good, let's do it. And we're sort of on the other side of that now, where we're recognizing – anyway, I've said too much, but Farrow – what is it called? Allen versus Farrow, HBO Max, watch it. Ryan, your recommendation.
So I really don't have a recommendation this week because I haven't consumed that much new content. I did watch a documentary from like 2010 or 11 called Bill Cunningham, New York.
Oh, I love that movie.
Now, I love the subject of the movie. The movie itself is not very well made, but it...
Oh, I disagree.
But it's... But like his life is so... It was so... He passed away a few years ago. He is... an amazingly brilliant, has such an incredible eye, and really captured the spirit and the fashion of New York City in such an amazing way.
For those who don't know, Bill Cunningham was a longtime photographer and columnist for Women's Wear Daily and Paper Magazine and Details and ultimately the New York Times.
Right.
And he was famous for these fashion pictorials where he would just go onto the street with his camera and take pictures of usually women.
Yeah.
And show a trend that no one else had recognized yet. And then the next year, that trend would be on every runway.
Yeah. And I didn't know this, but he lived in Carnegie Hall.
Yes.
He was one of the last tenants to live there. And there's actually a new documentary about his life that came out in 2018. The documentary is good. There are some things about it that I just kind of thought,
God, like, I loved it. I saw it in the movie theater.
Yeah.
Bill Cunningham's New York. JB?
Okay. So, again, like Ryan, I haven't consumed much TV because I'm a binger, and all my favorite CW shows just started back up. So I'm waiting until they have enough episodes so I can watch them. But I do recommend you guys do pick up a book and read. For the past couple of weeks, I've been through my adolescent depression over this new place. I've been collecting comic books.
Oh.
And I haven't been reading them because it's been hard to try to get them all in order because some of them stop printing in print. And then some of them just don't exist. So now I finally got a good chunk of them. I started binge reading, and it's great.
I love the thought of JB in his apartment, like on his bed, flipping through comic books.
No, I'm actually on my couch with my feet up, flipping through comic books, a blood in my hand, and I'm just laughing.
Oh, you get stoned and read them?
Yes, it's the best.
That's fun.
Ever. It's like I'm actually there.
You're such a sweethearted nerd.
I am. Love you,
JB. The big old nerd. All right, well, let's get started. We're going to whip through some actual news that broke over the past week that's fairly significant for the LGBTQ community. The first is that the Equality Bill has passed the House of Representatives on February 25th. This is a bill that would amend federal civil rights laws to prohibit discrimination against LGBTQ individuals in employment, housing, and public schools, among other areas. Mm-hmm. You know, the Supreme Court kind of already did this for us. They had a ruling come out last year, which was a big surprise to everyone. It was before Amy Covid Barrett was on the court, mm-hmm. but it was still a conservative court that ruled that that the 1964 Civil Rights Act protected us from discrimination in the workplace and other areas. But there's been a movement now for a couple of years to actually codify this with U.S. law. So it already passed once. They took it up again now that Biden is president. He has, you know, pledged to sign it the moment it lands on his desk. It only passed 224 to 206. Three Republicans joined all the Democrats in favor of the legislation. But there's no way it's going to pass in the current Senate, even though we're 50-50 and Kamala Harris is a tie-breaking vote. To get anything done, you have to have 60 votes because of the goddamn filibuster.
I hate it so
much. I hate that filibuster.
Hate you, filibuster.
My new drag name is
I was just about to say
Phyllis Buster.
I was going to say drag king Phil-a-buster.
Phil-a-buster. Phil-a-buster.
Every time I hear the words filibuster, I think of Parks and Recs. And she's just going on and on and on and on just to waste time. I was like, that is the most white people-ish rule I ever heard. Like, you could just sit there and just talk for hours about nothing as long as you don't stop. Fair.
Well, my friend Walt says, fuck the filibuster. Yes, fuck it. Anyway, so like I said, it's not going to pass under this Senate, but it's a symbolic victory.
Yeah.
And, you know, we march forward.
We'd love to see it.
In other good news, this was a surprise to me. The largest evangelical adoption agency in America will now allow LGBTQ adoption.
Yes.
Here's another good drag name. The name of the adoption agency is Bethany Christian Services. Bethany Christian Services.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the stage. Bethany Christian Services.
The judges thought your adoption was discriminatory.
Stop.
Anyway, so they announced last Monday that they would begin providing services to queer parents nationwide effective immediately. They are based in Michigan. They announced the change in an email to 1,500 staff members. It's a significant departure for this 77-year-old organization, the largest Protestant adoption and foster agency in the U.S. They facilitated over 3,400 placements and 1,100 adoptions in 2019. They have offices in 32 states. You know, this has long been a big controversy in the evangelical world. When a lesbian couple in Philadelphia attended a Bethany information session on foster parenting in 2018, they were told that this organization has never placed a child with a same-sex couple, and they were eventually referred to another agency. That prompted the city of Philadelphia to suspend contracts with Bethany's local branch and with Catholic Social Services, which is another agency with the same practice. So basically, they were facing pressure from cities.
Yeah.
Democratic-run cities are the only thing holding this country together right now. Like,
basically.
Seriously, we'd be living in fucking Nazi Germany if it weren't for them.
Aye, aye.
So now Bethany says, Bethany, if you're listening, she says, we're opening the door to more families and more churches. We recognize there are people who will not be happy with this. We may lose donors, but the message we're trying to give is inviting people alongside of us. Serving children should be non-controversial. A fucking man.
Period. And that's on period, as the kids say.
On period.
Okay. Period. With okay. DT.
Yeah,
DT. Period.
Because okay. I'm what? Sickened.
Meanwhile, professional garbage person Marjorie Taylor Greene was back in the news this past week. This is the Georgia Republican QAnon supporter. So there's this other representative in Congress named Marie Newman. She's a Democrat from Illinois. She has a trans daughter. So she was speaking out on the floor of the House about this Equality Act that we just talked about in support of it and in support of her daughter. And she decided to hang up the trans flag outside her office in support of her daughter. She happens to her office happens to be located across the hall from Marjorie Taylor Greene's. So in response to the trans flag, Greene posted a large sign outside her office that said, "There are two genders, male and female. Trust the science."
Oh my God. I don't even know where to begin with this. She is an actual garbage person.
She
is disgusting. Now, did I see something, like, did she get this printed, like, there in Congress?
I wasn't sure how she got it printed. It was a pretty, you know, professional-looking sign.
Is that using taxpayer money? Like, what the...
That's a good question.
She makes me so angry, and, yeah.
Many people were outraged, including our friend, Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who I still would like to blow, even though he voted against the Equality Act. But he spoke out and said this – because she made a video of it too, Marjorie did. He said, "This video and tweet represents the hate and fame-driven politics of self-promotion at all evil costs. This garbage must end in order to hashtag restore our GOP. I happen to feel like the GOP was never good and cannot be restored, but – at least he's, you know, saying the right things." On Thursday morning, Congresswoman Newman tweeted from her campaign account, "For every step of progress we take in the fight for equality, there are hateful folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene doing everything in their power to drag us backwards. But despite the efforts of people like her, love always has the last word. Onwards." And to Marjorie Taylor Greene, I say,
shut up, cunt!
No offense to anyone named Marjorie out there.
Marjorie is the new Karen.
Marjorie is the new Karen. You heard it here first.
Oh, dear. You know, there are a lot of horrible Marjories. And yet my friend Mike, my best friend when I was very little, his mom is Marjorie. And she was the loveliest person. So
there's a
I don't want to paint all Marjories with the same brush.
Is there a lyric in a musical or like a – What is the cultural reference point to Marjorie? Like,
there's Marge Simpson,
right? But Marjorie
in Miss Congeniality, Candace Bergen plays, I think, Marjorie Morningstar. I think is her name.
That's a great name, actually.
Oh, you know what? In Designing Women, that's part of Dixie Carter's famous speech when the lights go out in Georgia. She says, and just so you know, Marjorie.
Yeah.
Marjorie Lee Winnick is the reigning Miss Georgia world.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, we knew there was something. Meanwhile, a couple weeks ago, I was talking about the Tamron Hall interview with Sherry Pye and what a disaster it was. And I mentioned that I had reached out to Sherry Pye and said, like, come on my podcast. We'll do a real interview. Mm-hmm. We'll take the whole hour. You know, I don't want to excuse you. I don't want to apologize for you, but I want to know shit. And
right.
Tamron told us nothing. Well, someone else beat me to it. Logan Slaughter, who also goes by Logan Hardcore, is a New York drag queen who I've known since she was literally a baby. I remember when she was like first time in drags.
Yeah.
But she's come a long way, and she has a podcast that's quite popular.
She was actually the first queen I ever saw on Fire Island.
Logan Hardcore? Yeah. She was like the reigning queen of Fire Island for a while, which is where I first met her.
Yeah.
But anyway, she got Sherry Pye on, and I was so excited to hear it because, you know, Logan was like, I didn't hold back. I asked her the questions everyone wanted to hear. And I like Logan, and Logan did her best. But I am still hugely disappointed.
Not satisfied.
I'm not satisfied by this interview because, first of all, some of it's not Logan's fault. Sherry Pie, Joey, is a terrible person to interview because he does this thing where he starts to answer and then 5 seconds later he interrupts himself and then he interrupts himself again. So he never gets anything out. I listened to this entire hour and 20-minute long thing and this was the best soundbite I could find. Play it,
JB. Coping mechanism. Yeah. It was the way that I kept men. And if you notice, they're all, you know, these men are like they all provided something to me as a person. Right. And I would say, like, at the end of the day, my greatest fear was to let go of them. But then when it would all end, my brain would just compartmentalize it and just put it away. I didn't even think, you know what I mean? I wouldn't even think about it. Just boop, 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 boop. And I'd have a night of craziness in my apartment. A night I couldn't sleep. Like, it would be like an evening of not sleeping, of just like freaking out. Spinning. And then the next day I just wake up and I, you know, put that person away in a box.
And I want to ask, just because something I was given an email states that this, it happened with you as Joey in person. Someone read a monologue for you after a show that you were in, where you spam a lot, I believe. And there was a party afterwards and you were in a room and the guy read a monologue and then you were, you know, it was kind of the same story and
yeah.
You were a little sexual. He left. And then you, after that, tried to get pictures and videos of the monologue and whatnot from him. So I just want to know, was this only online or was this something that happened with you in person as well?
This is mostly only online. I mean, I like had rehearsal with people.
So like there was
but
yeah, that went on a little longer than I had planned, but you sort of get the gist. She it's very hard to get information out of her. It's hard to get straight answers out of her. I liked that moment because at least you had a glimpse into like her brain, like what was going on in those moments where she would start catfishing someone. But the bottom line is I still want to know, like, what is your obsession with muscles and steroids, and how can you keep saying that this wasn't sexual when you asked men to masturbate in front of you and on camera? Like, how is that not sexual?
Right. Because initially it was like a power thing.
It's about control.
Yeah, control.
And that's, I'm sure that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
People do get off on control, but I want to ask her, like, so you never jerked off to these videos? You never jerked off to these pictures?
Yeah.
She also claims that only one man took steroids, which I don't believe is the truth. And even if it is, she still tried to get a lot of other people to do steroids.
Yeah.
She tried, like, all of them. That was, like, her thing. And they didn't really get into that. They didn't really get into sort of the fact that she treated these people like objects. Like, they weren't real to her. And how did she justify that in her head?
Yeah.
I keep saying she. It's a guy. It's Joey. But
well, you can kind of see the justification right then and there. This is someone who clearly has never learned to let go of people and let go of things. Like, she has severe abandonment issues. Like, I went through that, but I had to realize that, oh, I gotta let people go, or this is gonna destroy me, or this is gonna make me insane. She hasn't learned that, and it's kind of sad. But there are people like that who pretty much either got punched in the face or got their heart broken.
Absolutely. And actually, Joey says, like, I have a huge abandonment fear. And when I would feel like I was about to lose someone important to me, that's when I would do this. But I still want to ask, what was the day that you first – that Allison Mosse first appeared? How did it happen? What went through your head? How did you come up with that name? What did you tell yourself as you were doing it? Like, there are so many questions about the process that I'm interested in.
Right.
But listen, give it up to Logan. She did her best. Sherry, Joey,
if you're listening,
the invitation still remains.
This will be something, though, that we will see unfold even more, I think, over the next couple of years. Like, I think this is a fascinating story. I would not be surprised if this ended up on fucking SVU or something.
Totally. Oh my God. Yeah.
You know,
also, this is the last thing I'll say. Logan did ask a great question, which is, how many guys do you think you did this to? And Joey says, about 20. And Logan says, okay, just so you know, we've heard from more than 40 who say that this happened. And Joey's like, okay. Well, apparently, as Logan was preparing for this, I mean, Logan's a drag queen, so she's in that world and, you know, has talked to people. And as she was getting ready to do this, she also spoke to a bunch of victims. Mm-hmm. And this is a great thing she's doing. Her next few episodes are going to be with victims.
Yeah.
So she's spending as much time with victims as she is with Joey. But as people, as she started emailing people and reaching out to people, she started to hear from a lot of people. And someone put her in touch with the fact that there had been 40 men who had – and I've heard that too. Hmm. And Joey doesn't really have an answer for it. So I don't think he is taking responsibility yet.
Right.
I really don't. Anyway, this brings us to our weekly – our biweekly RuPaul's Drag Race update. And last night was this season's Snatch Game, which is always the most important episode. So without further ado, take it away, Frost Pig.
Shantae, you stay.
Well, I was very happy to have an actual episode again, because we had a week where there was a COVID documentary, which we really did not need, but we had it. So last night was the Snatch Game, and there were some, I really thought there were some great performances. I thought Simone as Harriet Tubman was amazing.
Amazing.
Amazing. That was such a great choice. I thought Mick did an amazing job as Paris Hilton. I thought that was perfect for him. But what really frustrates me so much is that this is season 13. Okay. This is a show that has had several Snatch Games. So if you want to be on RuPaul's Drag Race, if that is something, because not every drag queen wants to be on Drag Race, but if you want to be on Drag Race, you need to be prepared to make RuPaul laugh in the Snatch Game.
Yes.
RuPaul does not want to see, what was her name? The one that Olivia did, the vegan chef.
Yeah, no one knows who that
is. It's like making RuPaul laugh is one of those things where he kind of laughs like he thinks Candy Muse is so funny. So anything Candy Muse does, like, he's going to laugh. And so he, like, I thought that was a brilliant choice to do Patrick Starr, because it was like, it fit Candy's.
Yeah, she could play herself.
Right. But to pick someone like Bob Ross, to pick someone like, what was
Rue McClanahan? Oh, Tina did Richard Simmons.
Rue McClanahan. That was offensive.
That was offensive because
that was offensive.
If you're going to do Rue McClanahan, if you're going to do
a gay
Blanche,
icon,
then have like 10 lines, 10 of her famous lines from the Golden Girls ready to go. She didn't say one of them.
It was just
when Rue said, "How you doing tonight?" She should have said, "I'm as jumpy as a virgin at a prison rodeo."
Right.
I mean, there's a million things you could say.
It just felt like a lot of these contestants were not. It definitely. I thought that was.
And four of them were garbage.
To sashay away.
Absolutely. She just wasn't ready. But I was really shocked Simone didn't win or wasn't even in the top.
Yeah, that was – there was something weird about
that. I thought it was so brave and bold to do Harriet Tubman, and it could have been Harriet Tubman, like a sassy, badass bitch who doesn't take any
– And I think that's what RuPaul is looking for. I mean, obviously, you know, it didn't get her the win, but you have to be – there has to be there has to be wit, it has to be clever, it has to be fresh, and you have to make Rue laugh. Like, just because you think it's funny, or just because you think you look like this person, or you think, I mean, Utica?
Disaster.
With the squirrel, because she said she didn't want to wear
it. She thought it was offensive to have an afro. So and RuPaul's like, you know that Bob Ross is white, and white people have afros.
Yeah, it was the strangest.
It was a strange choice.
And so she ended up wearing a squirrel afro. She made a hair
and did a cowboy voice instead of Bob Ross doesn't have a twang.
Yeah.
But Bob Ross talks like this.
Right.
She couldn't do it. It was terrible.
So I was entertained, but it was definitely frustrating because.
How do you think it ranks among other Snatch Games? Because I put it near the top. I think there were some real standouts.
I agree. I think that I think there were people that were really strong, and then there were other people like Denali and Rosé that complemented the entire panel. You know, it's like they obviously weren't the winners, but they had zingers. Mm-hmm. They were keeping things moving.
I think Gottmik was brilliant as Paris Hilton, and I thought that was a deserved win. And I love that the first trans male on Drag Race is stunningly talented.
Yeah.
Because it would have been iconic even if he had just been like a filler queen, but the fact that he's good at everything, it really, it's yeah, terrific.
I'm really excited to see the rest of the season. It feels like it's going to be a never-ending season. I think that they are trying to stretch this out as long as possible because they're really hoping to do an in-person finale. I don't think it's going to be live in a theater necessarily, but it'll either be like back in the studio or they'll do something outdoors.
One of our Instagram viewers says that Simone forgetting that Jennifer Lewis,
okay, that
was not that what did she was, think it was?
She thought it was Jennifer
the one
Lawrence.
You hate, Jennifer Lawrence. Yeah. Our listener says that's what kept her safe and not in the top.
I think so. Yeah.
I think that people were offended by that.
I think so.
All right, we got to move on.
Okay.
Thank you, Ryan Frosted.
Yes.
We're going to do two more quick stories and then bring on the fabulous David Drake. First of all, the Golden Globes happened this past week. I watched. They were strange. I think they did what they could with them. The whole Tina and Amy in separate studios and split screen didn't really work that much for me. But the highlight, as far as I'm concerned, was Jodie Foster winning for something called the Mauritanian and kissing her wife.
Yeah.
Who was next to her either in a bed or in like a comfy sofa. Her wife is Alexandra Hedison. And she wrote, Jodie said, "Are you kidding me? I think you made a mistake. I'm a little speechless. I never expected to ever be here again. And wow, I have to thank all my amazing filmmakers." And then she planted a kiss on Hedison. You know, for many years, Jodie was totally in the closet. Mm-hmm. In 2013, she publicly acknowledged having a former female partner during the Golden Globe ceremony. That was Cindy Barnard. Foster and Barnard had two sons together, and then they separated. And then Foster married Hedison. I didn't even know she was married. But if you remember that Golden Globe speech from 2013, she kind of played it very coy, and she was like, "I'm not Honey Boo Boo. Mm-hmm. My personal life isn't up for examination or whatever." And I was kind of like, that's offensive. Mm-hmm. Like telling us that you're gay is not airing dirty laundry.
Yeah.
It's just telling us who you are.
Right.
And to me, it's really gratifying to see Jodie Foster, who's now 58, to just be able to say, "Here's my wife," and kiss her in front of the world.
It's like, super cool.
We'll talk about progress.
Yeah.
It's huge. So congratulations to Jodie. And finally, I should have asked JB to get the love can take us there music, because there was some big news this week. New York City's Heritage of Pride March on June. Yes. There we go. On June 27th, we'll have some in-person elements.
Wow.
Pride is
orgies?
Partially back. Orgies is what, yes, that's what the organizer said. No, the group that produces the event said that there will be virtual programming again. But just listen to the music while I try to find out the rest of it. But that in-person elements will be part of it. It's happening June 25th. You know, last year was the Queer Persons Liberation March.
Queer Pride March. queer Liberation March.
Yeah, I think it was QPC. Anyway. It kind of was the thing because, yeah, first of all, it was in person with everybody in masks, and it was specifically to stand with queer people of color,
yes,
and with Black Lives Matter. And to me, it was like the most powerful Pride event I'd ever been to.
Yeah.
And for years, everyone has been saying that the big Pride event had become so commercialized.
Totally.
It was just a nonstop marketing blitz, and that it was ignoring people of color, and it was ignoring the problems with police brutality. And so already, the mainstream Pride, if you will, has taken this under advisement, and this year there will be a huge focus on queer people of color.
Yeah.
It will be a
2019
was huge.
Huge. And then to go from that to something that was really meaningful and important and significant, and you know, even though it was 100 degrees that day.
Do you have a napkin over there?
Yeah.
Sorry. Thank you. Go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, it was. I think it was necessary for us to take a step back as a community and remember why Pride exists.
Exactly.
And
it had become a very white, very privileged, very,
yes,
corporate-driven event.
Yes.
And So there's two good things to come out of this story. One is that slowly life is returning to normal and there will be some kind of in-person elements to Pride, and also that they're going to focus on issues pertaining to communities of color. So with that, I will say goodbye to Instagram. If you want to hear the interview with David Drake, you have to subscribe to dnrstudios.com or wait till next week. Bye, guys. Mwah. Are we ready, Jamie? You're not picking up? Oh, good. Let's just keep listening to the music then.
Love can take us there.
Sing it. You still don't know the words.
I know. How do I not know this? Fly high. Oh, that's not it. I wanna just like blast this and like twirl in a circle right now.
Do it. Ryan and I are dancing. Ryan just pulled his pants down. He's shaking that ass. He just farted. Ryan, please.
I'm sorry.
That scallion bagel.
That shitty bagel you got me.
We had bad bagels today from the bodega on my street because
we
lately
we tried something new.
Well, because our regular bagel place lately has been garbage. So, how we doing?
Big.
I can't hear you with the music.
Do you want the honest answer or want me to lie to you?
No, tell me the truth.
He's not picking up and his mailbox is full. So I can't like leave a voicemail with our number and tell him to call back.
Hold on. Call is coming from the studio, period.
The call is
keeps
coming.
Going to voicemail, period.
The call is coming from
we're experiencing
the
technical difficulties. He just texted me his phone number, which I am texting. Okay, try one more time, JB.
Okay.
You're trying 646. Yeah. Oh, what am I doing? You're trying this number?
Yeah.
Why don't I give out David Drake's phone number on the air?
Just give out all his personal information. That's okay.
The call is coming from inside the studio. If this doesn't go through, JB, he's going to call us. Anyway, Ryan, tell us a story about Bodhi.
Oh, my goodness. Dog. My dog, Bodhi. Well, he is humongous now. He is 45 pounds.
Hello, Mr.
And it's getting kind of hard to...
Is he completely toilet trained at this point?
Yes.
Good.
Absolutely. He's really good about that.
All right, here we go.
All right, here we
Thank
go.
Thank you for that.
Yes,
fascinating
thrilling,
story.
Thrilling.
Okay, our guest today won an Obie Award for his seminal 1992 one-man play, The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me. Before that, he starred for 2 years in the off-Broadway sensation Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. And if those two things are not enough to solidify his status as a gay icon, then surely the fact that he appeared in the movie's longtime companion and Philadelphia does. He is currently the artistic director at the Provincetown Theater, all the way from beautiful Provincetown, Mass. Please give a warm-ass welcome to David Drake. David, the audience is going wild now that we can finally speak to you. How are you?
I'm good, man. How are you? I sound like 100% gay, right?
Very gay. Those are some gay credits, man.
Those are some gay-ass credits.
How are things in beautiful Provincetown today?
They're beautiful, actually. It's sunny, cold. It's really nice today. Yeah.
Such a lovely place.
Oh, my God. I know. Well, you know, in the off season, there's only like 2,800 people who live here. So it's literally a small town.
A sleepy seaside village.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
David, I have a million questions for you, but I'm going to start by telling you a story.
Okay.
I'm going to be real self-indulgent and make this about me.
Just do it.
Because you're part of the story. So I came out to my family in 1992.
Okay.
I flew home from college to tell them at Thanksgiving break. And my mother's reaction, other than weeping, was she decided that we all needed to come into New York and see a gay-themed play. And this was how they were going to help deal with their shock of me being gay. So the play they chose was The Destiny of Me by Larry Kramer.
Okay.
Now, I don't have to tell you that that's the sequel to The Normal Heart.
Correct.
And it's a brilliant play, but it's not necessarily the play that you want to see after your 21-year-old son has just told you he's gay.
No, because he throws bags of blood all around the hospital room. He's going to die.
Yes, it takes place in an AIDS ward. And as David just mentioned, there is a scene in which the patient splatters the front row with blood. So it was very difficult for all of them, especially my mother. And afterwards, we stepped out of the theater. We were at the Lucille Lortel in the West Village. And we stepped out, and we were all just kind of dazed and quiet. And we look up, and there's this giant billboard of you shirtless. And it says, "The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me." And my mother looks up at it and says, "They really do love him, don't they?" And I was like, "Yes, Mom, they do." So it's the fact that it's now almost 30 years later and I get to interview you is just crazy to me. And it just feels like full circle. So let me start with the play, with that play.
I wish you'd come to our show.
Well, I know. I wish we had gone. If we had gone to see your play, I think she would have been a lot more upbeat.
Oh, yeah. It has a hopeful ending. I mean, it's got a lot of rage and things like that in it, but which would have been good. Her understand where, or your family to understand where you were living.
Exactly.
You know, the world that you were living in, which was really fighting back against homophobia, AIDS, all those things.
It's so beautiful.
We won.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're still fighting, but
still fighting, yes.
The progress that's been made since then is incredible. I know that the play germinated in you after you saw The Normal Heart. And after Larry Kramer actually did kiss you. So I know you've told this story 1,000 times, but for my listeners, explain sort of how this developed and where it came from inside of you.
I'd love to. The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me is a story. The title story is it's a series of monologues in the play that sort of isolate different issues that I think I felt experiencing built the AIDS epidemic. And through my experience in ACT UP. And so it's through that prism of which Larry Kramer founded ACT UP, along with a bunch of other heroic individuals. And it galvanized the community to respond to AIDS and take the matters into our own hands. And, of course, it attracted a lot of young people like me, like Black Lives Matter is attracting young people today.
Mm-hmm.
But he wrote a play called The Normal Heart, which was made into a movie by Ryan Murphy, which is a brilliant movie, by the way, I think. And the play was a sensation. It really was a reflection of where we were at the time, which was fighting this epidemic. It's the story of the founding of Gay Men's Health Crisis, for those who might not know that. And Larry was one of the founders of that. Well, started in his apartment. So anyway, I saw that play on my 22nd birthday at the Public Theater in New York City, and it exploded my mind as to what was going on out in the world that was full of silence on the issue of AIDS and its relationship to gay men at the time. So it was a very startling moment of confrontation of what was going on and all this silence that was around it because the media wasn't reporting on these things. And slowly over time, this was in 1985, I think, 85. And I was like, I saw it on my 22nd birthday. And so the play becomes a series of birthdays. My birthday happens to fall on June 27th.
Pride Week.
And Gay Pride Week, right. That's the night. Right before the Stonewall riots technically take place on the 28th because they start at 2:00 in the morning on the 28th.
Yes.
But the night before is the 27th. So, and Larry's birthday is actually the 25th, which I found out over time by working with him alongside him, finding myself working alongside him in the ACT UP t-shirt booth on Gay Pride Day in 1990.
So now it's 5 years later after the Normal Heart.
Yeah, so over the course of those 5 years, the germination of the reality of what I was living in and through my 20s and as a young man, it builds up to where I find myself enraged and joining this group of activists the way all of us did because many, many, many people did to join this, to become part of the solution.
Right.
You know, like to become part of a solution that was going to take our energy, our power back, and change the course of this thing that was providing death for our brothers and sisters, but primarily our brothers at that time, and my friends, you know, who were dying and were sick. And so what could I do? I could help this. I became a foot soldier like everybody else at that time. You just stepped in and did your part, worker among workers. And that's what I think a lot of people do that now. They do it through their social media, certainly.
Right.
And that's really inspiring to me to see, like, people having their own voices out there, you know, young people. And it's encouraging, very encouraging to me. So that's what the night Larry Kramer kissed me is about, my awakening to political consciousness.
And he kissed you while you were actually working at that booth, correct?
Yes, because we discovered that our birthdays were 2 days apart and that mine was basically fell on Gay Pride Day. And he said, you know, that's the actual date of the Stonewall riots, to me. And I said, yeah, I know. And he was so charmed by the fact that I actually knew my own gay history that he leaned over and kissed me, just a sort of peck on the face. And that was the night Larry Kramer kissed me. But the kiss, before that, becomes an awakening. It's an awareness, the opening of my mind.
It's a symbolic.
My mind.
Right.
It's so symbolic, like, how kiss. The world was. It's a metaphor. And then there's a series of other monologues after that in the play, why I go to the gym, 12-inch single, club crawl. There's a series of scenes. And there's a vigil scene. There's a future scene that takes place at that time when the play opened in 92, on New Year's Eve 1999.
And in that epilogue, originally, you have Larry dead from AIDS.
Oh. You remember that. He hated that.
And he hated it, right?
Yes. He was like, why do you kill me off? Why do you kill me off? And what happened is I said, Larry, I changed it for him. Actually, I took it out, but eventually. But I was doing it to show, like, how important he was, significant to us. So that was a sensational or a great moment of despair for us when we lost Mr. Kramer.
Well, yes. And I mean, the world was fortunate enough to have him for another 20 years after that. But we did lose Larry in 2020, and I read your beautiful tribute to him on Broadway.com.
Oh, thanks.
Did the two of you remain in touch over these last 30 years?
We did. We became friendly, but there was a part of me that always wanted to keep a little bit of distance from him so that I didn't so I could still hear him, you know, that he had a close circle of people that he would argue with. And I didn't want to really get into that. I felt intimidated by some of those people and him. And it wasn't like he invited me in and then I rejected it. It was just, we kept a very, there was a bit of a distance in our dance together.
Yeah.
And over the years, so, you know, it's odd for somebody to take your name and put it in a title and revere you that way. And he didn't want people to think that I was, like, automatically his son, that he had made me do those things. And at the time, you know, in 1992, with my half naked body on a billboard in Greenwich Village for a year, it was like I was sexing up his image in a way that he felt a little intimidated by.
Right. And Larry always had a complicated relationship with sex, it seems to me.
Yes, that's right. And I didn't. I did in a way, but not that way.
David, did you get so much dick after this play blew up and you became famous?
I did get a lot of dick after when that show was happening.
I mean, you were in your 20s.
Yeah.
And you're a beautiful man, and you were up there saying all these things that every gay man could relate to, but they'd never been said before. No one knew what gay gym culture was like, and no one knew what it was to go to a cruising bar. And I mean, you sort of you blew all of this up in such an incredible way.
Well, part of what I felt like I was supposed to do at that time was, and how I discovered how I felt about things as a writer and an activist, as a person coming of age, was that I could reflect what was going on. I could witness what was happening and then act it out for you, like tell the story of that, you know. I was in the process finding who I was, too, when I was writing it. I didn't foresee that this would be like a show that would run in New York for a year and then tour the world and become a movie and all that stuff. That wasn't the objective. The objective wasn't a careerism.
Right.
It was an objective that had to do with what can I do that can help empower us? And one of the tools of empowerment is to say, and this is inside the normal heart itself, is we are here. This is what it is. This is part of my contribution. You'll find a lot of writers at that time, the golden age of, you know, gay theater, is that a lot of gay men were coming forward with their stories that way. And like, the only platform that we really had was live theater. I mean, we made our own magazines and things like that, but that was available to us to tell our stories
live
theater.
I'm sure it was very cathartic for you too.
And Terrence McNally and, you know, William Hoffman and Paul Rudnick and me. And if you go down the solo thing, there was like Frank Maia and Dudley Saunders. And
yeah,
there was a succession of people who were actually coming forward and just pushing their stories out there because they had no choice.
It was such a creatively fertile time because of the pressure that you were all under.
And there was also another piece of the pressure was censorship.
Yes.
And there was a lot of, in the early 90s, this is when Jesse Helms and some of these, you know, iconic demons of politics, they haven't gone away. They just changed the names.
Yes.
There was a lot of censorship issues of wanting to censor us queers and people who are queer allies, like Karen Finley, the performance artist, and Tim Miller and Holly Hughes. This was the NEA4, where they were denied funding from the National Endowment for the Arts because of the queer content of their work. This idea of silence equals death went into art and representation as well. This is a boom in gay publishing. This is a boom in gay congregating spaces. Whenever you put the pressure on for the queers, they automatically come together. It was like, you know, when Pulse, that the horrible Pulse massacre happened that day in June, what was that, like 5 years ago now? And the instinct, it was so interesting to me. Queer space and queer congregation is very interesting to me. I'm fascinated by it. And I mourn losses of it, which is that I was living in New York City at that time. And I only came up here to Provincetown because I got a job. But I came up here for a job because I run the Provincetown Theater as their artistic director now. But I was still living in New York at that time. And that happened. And we all just went to Stonewall. That was what was
I was there.
Facebook and said, we're meeting at Stonewall at 5 o'clock or 5:15 or something like that. And so that was it. It was like we came from all over the city to our place. And there was no agenda yet. It was just we have to be together.
David, we have just a couple minutes left, and I hate to cut you off, but I just want to say coming out when I did, I consider myself very fortunate, and you were one of the people who really paved that road for me. So I want to thank you.
You're welcome.
For your beautiful work.
I did it for you.
Thank you. I'm not much younger than you either. So I just wasn't doing that when I was 22. Anyway,
we don't have our place there. You know what I mean? I love doing that. I love the brotherhood concept of it all.
Well, thank you.
You know, if I can be part of like keeping the door open while you come through or get out, great.
In the remaining moments, we're going to play everyone's favorite at-home quiz show. It's called Ask Me No Questions.
Ask me no questions.
Ask me no questions.
Yeah. Ready?
Yep.
Besides Larry Kramer, which famous activists have kissed you?
Peter Staley.
Yes.
who else?
How about Cleve Jones?
No, not Cleve Jones. I've never met Cleve Jones.
Aw.
Weird, I know. Harvey Fierstein, all of the other ones I've probably met.
Hello.
Hello, David. Yes. what's another question?
David, your real name or your birth name was David Dracula.
That's correct.
Dracula liked to suck blood. What do you like to suck?
All the orifices.
Yes. Good answer. I'm going to give you an F, marry, kill. Have you ever played this game?
No.
You have to fuck one, marry one, and kill one.
Okay.
And these are all famous Davids. Your choices are David Duchovny, David Spade, and David Hyde Pierce.
Fuck David Duchovny.
Yes.
During the X Factor days, for sure. Mm-hmm. Even now, sure, what the hell. At night, all cats are gray. fuck, marry, or kill?
Yes.
Kill David Spade and marry David Hyde Pierce.
That is the correct answer.
Thank you.
How active is the dick talk, the dick doc this time of year?
How active is it?
Yes.
Well, if you're a seal, it's very active. It's really cold out there.
The seals are getting a lot of action.
I don't know, but there's some new graffiti down there that got put online. So clearly, the artists are taking advantage of Dick Doc these days.
Yeah, why not? Okay, yeah. There are 6 David Drakes listed in Wikipedia. Of the three who are still alive, one of them is you, one is a chef. Who is the third one?
A Christian writer.
Yes.
Christian sci-fi writer. Christian on his website, he says, I am not the gay activist David Drake.
Wow.
Shut up, cunt.
That's what I have to say to him.
There's a comedian named David Drake, too. He's a straight guy, I think, in Chicago.
He did not warrant his own Wikipedia page. But when I was doing research on you, this David Drake, the Christian sci-fi writer, kept coming up. And I was like, who the fuck is this? Okay, what has been the single most exciting moment of your life?
Oh, God. Well, it actually is the night Larry Kramer kissed me when we did the Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS Benefit. When a few years ago, we did a 20th anniversary.
Yes, 2013.
And I adapted it for 12 men.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was an incredible cast.
Yeah, it was a lot of people I knew. I wanted all openly gay people, and it was like Andre the Shields and B.D. Wong.
Robin De Jesus.
Robin De Jesus, Wes Taylor, Aaron Tone, Brandon Cudero, Chad, I can't think of Chad's last name.
Oh, Chad Ryan, who I know Chad from therapy. Ryan. We've had him on the show.
Yeah, Chad Ryan, Claiborne, Clay Elder, and Rory O'Malley, and Anthony Rapp.
Incredible lineup.
They were incredible. And I've done some of them. I dated Anthony back in the day, a million years ago.
A little interesting dirt. So listen, the 30th anniversary is right around the corner. Do you have anything planned?
For me. Oh, my God, that's right. But yeah, that was a really amazing moment because the play for me was really about how did I fit into the community? And so in that way, as a solo piece, it was about community, right? It encompassed a lot of different characters and people and situations that became a reflection of an aspect of the gay male community at that time. And so to open it up for 12 actors and give them each different pieces and myself, it became the community, the reflective community that it was always intended to be. So that was a really special, great moment. And to make, you know, $68,000 or whatever it did for Broadway Cares and Tom Viola, who was an original producer of the play.
Wonderful.
That was a great moment for all of us.
David, we're going to have to leave it there. I can't thank you enough for doing this show, but also just for all of your work and all the good that you have pumped into the universe over the years.
Well, I hope to pump some more.
Keep pumping. Love you, baby.
I will.
Thank you so much,
bye.
David Drake.
Thank you.
Tune in next week to hear another brand new Adam Sank show with our special guest, comedian and radio host John Fugelsang. Subscribe to this motherfucking podcast at dnrstudios.com and download the DNR Studios app. Don't forget to order all of your ass merchandise at adamsank.com. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam Sank. Follow Ryan at Ryan Frosting. Follow JB at Stocking Anarchy 12. Email me at adam@adamsank.com. Have a great week. Bye.